हरिः ॐ सहनावतु सहनौभुनक्तु सहवीर्यङ्करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्तिश्शान्तिश्शान्तिः ॐ जय श्रीकृष्णचैतन्यप्रभुनित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सनि गौर भक्त वृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
ओके 4-2 ओके सो नाउ इफ वी नोटिस इन हियर इन दीज मेन हेडिंग्स दैट इन ब्रह्मचारी लाइफ दैट Yeah. Principles that we see here from the previous page and this page, then we'll see that is in their study, then they must be respectful. Right? The conduct must be good. Their sadhana is proper. And the senses are under control. And that knowledge should only be given to someone who is of good character. Otherwise, if they're not of good character, then the Vedic knowledge is not to be given. Transcendental knowledge, people can maybe hear if it's not too deep, you know, for their benefit, but you even don't go too deep on that. But the Vedic, you just don't give them anything at all. That's the difference. So then here, then, respectful behavior towards gurus. Here, gurus means means anyone who is guru. That means the mother, the father, the teachers, the acharya, you know, senior members of the family, all these are there. So one thing you'll also notice when they go through here, it's a principle in when in the Vedic literatures, then when they're describing something, then you get Hare Krishna, is whichever ashram or varna exemplifies the particular activity the most, that's where it's explained in detail. Does that make some sense? So in other words, it's not that what's described in Brahmachari Ashram that's only for the Brahmacharis, and then what's described in the Grihastha Ashram is only for the Grihasthas, and what's in the Vanaprastha is only for them. There's certain principles that are common to all of them, though it would be presented through the medium of that ashram, because that ashram exemplifies it the most. Just like in here, then, menial service, study, respect, cleanliness, these basic things are very prominent in the Brahmachari Ashram because they're getting trained in these things. So they will stand out the most here. But how you deal with the teacher, how you respect seniors, how you study the scriptures, it's the same for the Grihasthas, Vanaprasthas, and Sannyasis. Does that make sense? But so the certain elements that are specific to the Brahmachari Ashram, like how they'll dress, you know, or some certain duties, like they go out begging or like that, that may change. But otherwise, the principle is always there, just like the Grihastha, because they have the... So the Brahmachari, because all they do is study, therefore study is described there, because it's the main thing. But you take something like performance of sacrifice, or giving in charity, or receiving guests. So the Grihastha has the greatest facility for that. It's a main part of their duties. So then all those things will be described in that area. Or certain things on really dealing with the senses, controlling the senses, then that will be the Vanaprastha's main focus. So then that will be prominent there. Though everybody, how you control your senses is then seen there. Or the sannyas, then the knowledge, seeing everything that they do in connection with knowledge. But that same knowledge is applicable to everybody. Does that make some sense? So like that, this is how it functions. Because the one ashram exemplifies it the most, so it will be described in full there. And others, it'll just be referred to sometimes. That's all. Because the details have already been given somewhere else. So it's a very interesting way to efficiently describe something. But at the same time, is one has to understand how the system works. Otherwise, one will think, oh, these are only for brahmacharis, or these are only for grihasthas, or only for vanaprasthas, like that. So then, position of the acharya, the four gurus. The preceptor is known as acharya. The sub-teacher means, a sub-teacher means who teaches a specific subject other than the philosophy or the Veda. They will teach you, like, let's say, Sanskrit or astrology or language or history or these kind of things. So they're called sub-teachers because they just teach you the subject. Right? The difference is the acharya teaches you how to live and the sub-teacher teaches you general knowledge. I mean, it may be specific for your occupation, but it's knowledge of this world. Well, the acharya teaches you how to use that in your life and to get out of the material world. That makes the difference between the two, in this case. Or sometimes if you're dealing with these big yajnas, then the acharya means the person who knows the same thing, but because it's a limited time, you know, you're doing in some big yajna ashramate or something, so for 1, 6, 9 months, 1 year, you may be doing the yajna. So then that guru is there, and he doesn't specifically do the yajna, but he's responsible that it all gets done. And so then, much of the time in the discussions between the intervals in the yajna, because you only do things in the morning or evening or sometimes at noon. So in between, the spaces in between, then who is performing the yajna and all the priests, then they'll all sit together and discuss the philosophy, histories, you know, different things from the Shastra. So then they will be like the senior person who would, you know, lead those things. At the same time, they are leading the rituals. So the priests, they know the rituals perfectly, but the acharya knows the rituals and the philosophy. That would be the difference. Does that make sense? But they're all, when you say teacher, it can mean all of what was described here. At the same time, it can mean just specifically the initiating guru or the acharya, or it can mean also the person who teaches you just a particular subject. Does that make sense? Then you have the family guru, means the guru, means there's two ways this would be. Family guru means the one who performs the samskars for the family. He's always there, gives the brahminical advice to the family, does the samskars for the family, takes care of these kind of things, like that. He may or may not be spiritual, right? But because he's taking care of the, you know, material well-being of the family, so he takes care of those things. So that means that would be here. He may also be a sub-teacher or a preceptor, but in any case, in this where they're dividing it, it means that he takes care of all the day-to-day direction, advice, samskaras, different things of ritual for the family to take care of. Then the last is the officiating priest, because then the family guru is the one that's there, and if you're doing a big enough program, big enough, you know, sacrifice or that, it may require other priests. So then the family guru will then bring in other priests like that to do, take care of the ritual and all those things. So basically this is an order of respect as we see here. Then the next, the teacher is the most venerable father. He who fills his ears with the Veda shall be considered as his father and mother. Birth for the sake of the Vedas ensures eternal rewards. Let him consider that he received a mere animal existence when he was born. The birth procured through Savitri is real, exempt from age and death. Who benefits him by instructions in the Veda, be it little or much, is Guru. The Acharya who teaches prescribed duties becomes by law the father. One destitute of sacred learning is a child who teaches him Veda, his father. Who has learnt the Veda with the Angas, Anuchana, is considered great. Like this. So, because what in here, this whole point of this section is that the parents must be respected. But this is for the brahmachari, because he's not living with the parents, so more prominent will be the respect for the teachers, though it's mentioned with the parents. But because the grihastha lives with their parents, or with the relative's parents, then more detail will be described there on respect of the mother, the father, the uncles, the aunts. It'll get very much detail of how you deal with each one. Like that, because they're living with them. But for the brahmachari, then it'll point out, since his purpose is spiritual development, then in this case, the most important of the parents then becomes the teacher. Then when they're at home, then he has to balance it. Because the parents have seen the need that they'll be trained in this line, so the parents have sent, so he already has their permission. So then in the school, then it depends on the permission of the teacher. But then when he's back after he graduates, he goes back home. Then he's again back with the family. So then day to day, he takes the permission of the mother and father. And in, you know, occasions or situations or decisions that require greater understanding or spiritual, then he takes permission of the guru, of the teacher. Does that make you see how it switches? Like that. But in any case, so then on here, it brings into perspective. So even then, between the parents and the guru, then that's considered that as far as the purusharthas, then, you know, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, economics, sense gratification, these things that the parents are the most involved with, because that's what they're taking care of. Grihastha life means those things have to be attended to. Because in the Varnashram system, everybody is trying for liberation and going back to Godhead. But they're using different methods. Right? The Brahmachari is not using economic development, sense gratification, neither is the Vanaprastha Sannyas. Grihastha is. So then, naturally, then those fields will be their field. Right? So one's care, one's health, one's well-being, those things, that will be prominent in the relationship with the parents, because that's their field of dealing. Well, in the preceptor, then that is how is the spiritual well-being, how you're going back to Godhead. So that will be the relationship there. But to do that, you have to be of good health. And the parents, to be of good health but not be Krishna conscious, doesn't have any meaning either. Right? So both will deal in both fields, but the emphasis with the parents will be more what's going on in this sphere, and the emphasis with the teacher will be more what's going on in that sphere. So this is how then it balances. So depending upon the sphere, then the prominence will be given more or less. Does that make some sense? So one has to be able to see that balance. At the same time, as if both the guru and the parents are there, then the guru is the more respectable of them. Because that birth is eternal. That connection is eternal. While the parents, the connection is as long as this lifetime. The next lifetime may be the same connection, may change. You know, generally we see changes there. You know, so many times. Like you get, it's one story where someone was, yeah. There was this Brahmin, I think, yeah. He went someplace. He went begging or something or that. He came to a house, and the lady of the house greeted him, you know, and asked him to come in, and she had some problem and everything like this. So he's listening and all this. Then, in that, you know, she could see he was someone of character and everything like this. And so then, yeah, so of good character and that, but she considered the husband was a bad character. You know, very mean, very nasty. So she told the Brahmin, so let's do one thing, I'll leave with you, leave this man, he's nasty. So the Brahmin says, no, this is not proper, I can't do that. So then the Brahmin left the house, you know, because he could see this is a dangerous situation. Then just after he left, and the woman came running out of the house, left the house, packed her bags, left, and then started, you know, claiming how this Brahmin was asked her to go with him. And so he's thinking, wow, what's going on here? So then, I think he was, you know, thinking about this, went into meditation and all that. I don't remember if it was revealed in meditation or in a dream. Then he understood that from last life, then the three of them had been connected. That wife and her husband and this Brahmin. He had been walking down the road. And while he was walking down the road, then some man was shouting that his cow had gotten loose, please catch the cow for me. So then he caught the cow, and then this man came and was very grateful and took the cow away. So it turns out that this man whose cow it was the butcher. And so the cow had run away when he was going to slaughter the cow. So now this cow has taken birth as the husband. And this cow, I mean, excuse me, the butcher took birth as the husband, and the cow took birth as this wife. So therefore, because of, you know, helping in this activity, though he didn't know what was going on, then he got this reaction. He was blamed in this life for something that seemingly hadn't anything to do with. So you get connections like that, but you can never say how it's going to be. Right? You know, very unlikely combination. The butcher and the cow become husband and wife. Right? You know, so you can never tell how it's going to move like that. So that's the principle. But from the acharya, you know that that connection is an eternal connection. So that one's then therefore considered the senior of them. But there's a natural mutual respect. That's the thing. There has to be a mutual respect between the two groups of parents, the spiritual and the material. So now that's established of the different teachers like that. And then the basis of seniority. Then who, though young, has learned the Veda, the gods consider venerable. Right? An unlearned Brahman is useless. Okay. So the young person, so it's said that there was this, that the Brahman may be very young. If you have a 10-year-old Brahman and a 90-year-old Kshatriya, then they are to each other like father and son. The Brahman being the father. Right? So therefore knowledge, sacred knowledge, is considered the most important of all the different, I think we went through that before, of all the different qualities. So that's most important. So therefore we see also amongst the devotees who has knowledge, but even more than knowledge is devotion, because higher than knowledge is that devotion. Right? Higher than jnana is vijnana. So the application of it and that understanding of it, that is higher. That's a higher principle. Gentle speech. Created beings must be instructed without giving them pain. Whose speech and thoughts are pure and controlled gains the goal of Vedanta. Right? Because the goal of Vedanta is to become God conscious. Let him not, even though in pain, speak words cutting others to the quick. So in other words, when one's speaking and all that, one should be very careful about one's behavior. One should always be is that in speaking, even if one is pained, then one should try to avoid language that is very cutting, right? Because one always has that choice. There's that one can express oneself, show one's discontent, point out logically how one thinks things should go this way or that way. But there is that point where you have the option to say something that will just hurt the other person. So the Vedas then say, don't use that one. Like that. Cultured people don't use. You know. So these instructions are general for everyone, but specifically those who are cultured have to follow. Right? If someone else doesn't follow, but is trying, that's okay. But it's specifically one is cultured, then one should be careful of this. So that is always a practice. Right? Means if one is habituated like that, then it's very nice. It should be maintained. It shouldn't be dropped. Even though others may or may not follow. If one doesn't have that practice, then one should be aware of it and try to develop that practice. And that would be very good for you. Like that. Because if one's gentle, that means one's self-controlled, right? To be gentle, we have to be self-controlled. So that gentleness comes in all spheres. In dealing when you're angry or upset or tired, or means these are all times, right? If somebody becomes grumpy, means that there's something wrong, right? So even if one's grumpy, one still has to be gentle, right? Because other people, they didn't necessarily aren't involved in your grumpiness, right? You know, they may have been doing everything nice, and for them it's a great day. And something happened to us, we're grumpy. So it doesn't mean that now the whole world has to share in our grumpiness. Like that. So therefore we should always be gentle. If we're gentle, then others will understand that there's some difficulty. And then they'll help. So better that way, then it's positive, than just we're grumpy. We make them grumpy and then we feel good. Well, at least this more than me is grumpy. You know, so like that. Well, it makes for a much more pleasant social interaction. That's the principle. Equanimity of mind. Brahman should always fear homage as if it were poison. Who is scorned may sleep with an easy mind, but the scorner utterly perishes. So, you know, who is scorned, then there's nothing to maintain, right? If you have a big you're known for so many things, or you're well respected and all that, that has to be maintained. But if you don't have any, then there's nothing to maintain, right? So you can sleep peacefully, right? We even see that other religions also make this point. The Buddhists make that point. Who cares? You know, he has nothing, or the Jains say, you have nothing. Others may criticize, who do you care? You know, you don't have these few people who criticize association, but you have all the living entities of the world, right? You have nothing, but your sky is your blanket, the whole earth is your bed. You know, so you have more than anybody, even though by material calculation you have nothing. Study of the Veda is the highest austerity. One sanctified by the above means shall perform austerity. An Aryan, while studying, must perform the prescribed austerities and vows. The study of the Veda is declared to be the highest austerity for a Brahmana. A twice born studying worldly topics while avoiding the Veda soon falls. So it's saying that one should be austere, but of austerities, the greatest austerity then is study of the scriptures. That's always considered to be the highest austerity. Like that. It means the verse mentions that a Brahmin, even though dressed nicely with a garland and, you know, sitting at ease and, you know, in a very comfortable situation, is performing austerities up to the extremities of the ends of his nails. It's that austere if he just studies the scriptures. So that's the best austerity. For the Brahmins, the best austerity is studying the Veda. For the Kshatriyas, then, is to protect the people. For the Vaishyas is to create economics. And for the Shudra is to serve without a grudging mood. So if that's there, then all these orders are performing their best austerities. Other things are then you want to get the heavenly planets, this, that. You can do separate austerities for that. So that's the principle. So we see for the devotees, if they're studying, they're chanting, they're following the principles, that's already austerity. You don't have to do more than that. Right? Sometimes devotees say, I got to become austere. No, you just have to do this. Right? Austere is something else. You know, I'll only eat, you know, one gulab jamun every 3 days. You know, something very, very serious. You know, something. But it's, no, they just have to study, you know, perform their duties. That's all. Because it mentions, for someone who's performing the above duties, means for someone who's following the principles of controlling the senses, respecting teachers, you know, then studying the Veda is the most austere, because he's already being austere. By offering respect, by being gentle, like this, then one is already austere, like that. Because you see, austere people, you know, otherwise, maybe doing austerity, but not for this purpose. So they're very austere, but they may not be nice. You know, there's someone who lives out in the bush, very austere, not necessarily very nice. You know, so everybody has their austerity. So first, second, and third birth. First birth is from the natural mother. Second, upanayanam. Third, initiation. Like that. So technically, in the Vedas, everybody has the first birth. Then the Dwijas have second birth. And then the Kshatriyas, then they have third. It means those who are in the Vedic, they would be initiated into performing these big Shrauta Yajnas, these big Yajnas that we always hear about. You know, Ashramedhas and these and that. Someone initiated into that, they're the topmost Brahmins. Like that, as far as this initiation goes. So they're called Twija. Like that. But for ourselves, then also we have that. There's that the Upanayanam is there, so that's second birth, and then the Pancharatrik initiation, which is above that, that's Twija. So technically the devotees who have second initiation, they're Twija. They're thrice born. Because then they're born into the transcendental. Because the Vedic is in between. You can use it either way. It can take you into the spiritual world, or it can just take you into the material world. Does that make sense? Like that. But the Twija, that one is for getting across into the spiritual planets. Because the Brahma Gayatri, as it generally stands, will get you to Brahman. So to go beyond that, then that requires devotion. So that's in the third birth. Does that make sense? Like that. The Guru is father and Savitri the mother. So the Guru is the father and the Gayatri is the mother. Sometimes also it's said the Guru is the father and the Vedas are the mother. So on that, it's there. So that is the difference. So the Guru may be father, but he's a different father than the biological, in that he's not connected with a wife. He's not father from that platform. He may have a wife, but still, in this relationship as initiating Guru, it's the Veda, the Gayatri, that is the mother, and not his wife. Though his wife is respected as mother. Does that make some sense? So it's a different thing. So one always has to see in that also, in dealing with the spiritual master, that it doesn't have that mundane element, because the mother is the Veda. Like that. So it has a different flavor to it. Slightly different. Yes?
You're saying that Savitri is the Veda, or is it Gayatri, or is it both?
It's both, because Savitri specifically means the Gayatri, because the Gayatri is the essential verse of the whole Veda. Because before, I don't know if we came across it, it mentions that a Brahman, if he just chants the Gayatri, then he knows the whole Veda. He's equivalent to one who knows the whole Veda. So that's the most important. So they always, the Brahman has to be chanting Gayatri. If he doesn't chant Gayatri, then how he'll be a Brahman? So that's the principle. So one who chants then knows all the Veda, because the Brahma Gayatri is the source of the Veda. Remember we were describing how Om turns into Burbhuvaswa, that turns into the Gayatri, that turns into Purusha Shukta, and that expands as the Veda. So if you have the Gayatri, then technically speaking you have the whole Veda. Does that make sense? Yeah. An initiate should not pronounce Vedic texts except those for funeral rites. So funeral rites are open to everybody, because somehow everybody dies. So it's a general principle, it's always open. But other texts that are for specific sacrifices, only those who are going to be doing those, then they'll deal with the mantras. Descriptions for students. Students observing the rules are instructed in Brahmacharya and the Veda. Whatever dress is prescribed at initiation, the like must be used for vows. So whatever their particular line is, because your different brahmacharis may dress in different ways. There's three options, like for dealing with their hair. One brahmachari shaves his head completely if they're impersonalists, or he puts it into dreads if they're not performing they're not performing deity worship. Or if they're performing deity worship, then they shave their head and leave a sika. So it just depends upon what particular purpose that they're following. So whatever he is the dress he's been given at initiation, that's the dress he uses when he performs his vows. In other words, that's his natural dress. He wouldn't use something else. Okay, so now we go back to topic 3. So sometimes you see this happens again also in the 8th chapter. I think it's there. Yeah, the 8th chapter definitely. There might be another chapter where you see is that there's a particular topic that is part of the other topic, but because it's so prominent, so major, it becomes its own topic. So you'll find it stuck in the middle. So it's not a matter of, that it's unchronological. It's just that in training the brahmachari, like you see, it goes back to prescribed duties. They must be trained in brahmachari in the Veda in the beginning, when it started. Then it says, the teacher must instruct pupils in cleanliness, conduct, and sadhana. Right? So in doing that, then he must know how to respect, his superiors. So then that comes in the middle. So topic 3, continue. Ordinances of studentship, duties of brahmacharya. A student residing with his teacher must observe the following rules. So he must perform daily worship. There's some restrictions in what he can do, what he can't do. Menial service and begging. So then those should be done. So let him fetch water, flowers, cow dung, earth, and kusa grass as much as required. The subsistence of a student on begging food is equal in merit to fasting. So the student who lives by begging, then it's equivalent of fasting. So from fasting you get, you know, so much great benefit. So by living in that way, it's equal to fasting. So we see that many times you have these things where if they perform this one activity, then they get the benefit of other activities. So this is how the brahmachari gets that benefit. Etiquette with the teacher. He shall always study the Veda and do service to his teacher. Then it describes the dress, the attitude, and respectfulness. You should avoid disrespect. Then if he's disrespectful, then so many different difficulties can come. Like you see these monster bugs here. You sometimes bump into them. There's one big, big water bug about this big. And then there's another one about like this. It's kind of square with big, funny legs that are bigger than them. And when they run, sometimes they hop and go like this. I don't know if you've ever seen them. Now again, you see them. So large bugs, I think, are for... I think of those who live at the expense of the guru. Like that. Donkeys are those who make fun of the guru. Like that. So you get these, you know, few different things that you get out of this. So that's why I'm saying here, results of disrespect. You know, they get a few. Like that. Further points of respectfulness. Sitting with the teacher, then it explains how, where one wouldn't sit on a higher, you know, I mean, on the equal platform, and where one could. You know, there's certain situations you can't sit in a different place. You know what I'm saying? Like you're sitting on this mattress or on a mat, you can't sit higher or lower. Like that. Or if you're sitting on a bench, or if you're sitting in a car, or you're sitting on a boat, or in a rock, you can't make those differences. But if you have the opportunity, if it's a formal situation, then naturally you make those differences. But in an informal situation, then these differences aren't made. So it gives the details of that. Then others who he's supposed to respect. Service is avoided for the wife of his teacher. It means if his teacher is young, then he has to he cannot do any personal service for her. If she's elder, then that's okay. Or he's very young. But if he's of age and knows what's right and what's not, then if the teacher's wife is young, then he doesn't deal with her. Like that. You know, things like helping her with her hair, or helping her take bath, or anything like that. But if he's very, very small, then it doesn't matter. Remaining on guard in the company of females. One should not sit in a lonely place with one's mother, sister, or daughter. And this is where Prabhupada quotes this one. So this is where he's quoting it from. Respect towards the wife of the teacher. So he must always come and offer his respects. The obedient student attains the knowledge lying hidden in his teacher. So if he's obedient and he serves, then what is hidden in the teacher, he gets that knowledge. Otherwise, he'll just get externally what he teaches. But actually, his mood, his method, and very, you know, secret portions of application that he will get through his submission and service. Hair and sleeping, we mentioned about hair. Sleeping means he doesn't sleep during the twilights or in the day time. There's the twilights in the day. One is, those are best times for spiritual activities. You know, so it's a waste of time. Two, Lord Shiva moves at those times, so it's a disrespect to him. Three, if you sleep at those times, it increases lust. So therefore, the brahmacharis always avoid sleeping at those times. Satisfaction by balancing the results of religious practice. Honoring one's superior, so there has to be a balance between how one is doing these things. One can't overdo in any direction. One has to be able to perform the activities that he can steadily always do, and then that is a proper, then so that it's progressive. That's a balance. Honoring one's superior is the teacher, father, mother, and elder brother must not be disrespected. So then more details are given here. Then acquiring knowledge in times of distress, taking gold from a dirty place, So it means that if you can't find a proper teacher to teach him everything, or to teach him actually the full etiquette and application and philosophy, then he may take on a teacher who can teach him something. Or he may take as a teacher someone who's not a Brahmin but knows the subject matter because they learned it. Because also Kshatriyas and Vaishyas, they study the same thing. But they don't teach it. They have other duties. So one could learn from them if no other one else is available. But as soon as the instruction is finished, then that relationship as teacher and student also ends. Like that. And then Naisthika Brahmachari, presentation of gifts to the teacher, means only after they've graduated. They don't present gifts before. And then service after the teacher's passing away, they continue their, you know, in other words, they continue just living as brahmacharis. They don't graduate. And then results of Naisthika Brahmachari, just it on its own can take you to Brahma Loka. If someone is a Naisthika Brahmachari and follows their whole life, just that itself will just take them to Brahma Loka. So that'll take them higher than the greatest kings doing the greatest yajnas. You do the Rajasuya, you do these biggest of big yajnas, it can only take you up to Indra's place. Sometimes it'll give you, you're pious enough, you can go with the sages up to Brahma Loka, Tapaloka, when they do some special programs. Many times the Brahma is doing special, you know, some special sabha, some special programs, so then those from the lower planets, heavenly planets, and the sages and like, the rishis, they go up there temporarily, you know, to go to the program, but they have to go out. But just the brahmachari being brahmachari his whole life, then he can go to Brahma Loka as a resident. So that's the minimum you get out of it. Like that. And then if they're devotees, then that's another thing. But just showing the potency of the brahmacharya. So that's the point here. Yeah. So then that ends the description on the brahmacharya, the duties there. Discourse 3, the grihastha ashram, the rule of bathing, graduation. So then that person who wants to get married and all that, then he graduates like that. Technically in the Gurukul system, only those who will get married graduate. The others never graduate because they are lifelong students like that. So there may be degrees they get, but they never graduate as such, because that's a specific samskar, like that. Because then after that, then they'll dress like a grihastha. A brahmachari who graduates, even he's not married, he dresses, though, the dress of the grihastha, and that. And then he can either on going home, immediately get married, or he can decide to travel and go and expand his knowledge by going and studying in other sabhas, or from, you know, specific knowledge he wants to get from specific teachers. Then once he's gained what he wants to gain, then he sits down, gets married, then he opens his own school, like that, if he's a Brahmin. Kshatriyas could also, as a snataka, go and travel, but rarely we see they do. They generally go back to the palace and spend their time being trained in the, you know, details of application of the politics and the, you know, of the Kshatriya duties. But that was Krishna's point to Jarasandha, is that even though, you know, because Jarasandha had a doubt that Krishna, Arjuna, and Bhima were Kshatriyas, right? Because they didn't, I mean Brahmins, because they didn't exactly look like, you know, just your normal, ordinary, you know, skinny Brahmin. So he had a doubt. So then in that doubt, then Krishna, he made the point, Kshatriyas can also be snataks. They can also graduate and go out traveling. So their dress will look the same. Means the snataka dress is that he wears a white dhoti, white chadar, like this. You know, he'll cut, if he has matted locks, he'll cut them off. So you won't be able to tell the difference between him and a grihastha, and you can't tell the difference between a kshatriya who's a snatik would also look the same. So it's only if he goes to the palace, then he'll dress as a kshatriya. But if he's out traveling, then he'll dress the same as a brahmana and perform the same duties, like that. But then when he wants to get married, then he'll take up his natural duties and dress. Does that make sense? So that's the snatak. Topic 6, the law of marriage. So then it describes appropriate and inappropriate arrangements. The appropriate arrangements then means that marrying a girl of equal nature who is not what's called sagotra or can't remember what the other. You remember? Sapinda, yeah. Sagotra or Sapinda. So sagotra means that they're from the same line going back to in Prajapatis. Means that Brahma had 10 sons, then they expanded the universe, and from that second expansion, in other words, between the sons and grandsons of Brahma, then 21 of them were chosen as Prajapatis. And they then populated the universe. So all the species, 8,400,000 species of life, come out of those Prajapatis. So gotra means that you know your family line back to the particular one of those 21 gotras. So in India, then people will know that, and that's considered important. You know your gotra, then you're considered a good family. You don't know the gotra, then it's considered that it's less. It's not as good because you're not. Then how do you tell? How do you tell if they're the same? So the idea in the Vedic, they're very careful about the bloodlines. You know, it means like in the West you don't marry first cousins. But that's the limit that they deal with. So that basically ensures this, but at the same time it may not. Because, so sagotra means it's a different line. So when a girl goes to another line, she changes gotra. So then it's not counted anymore. But because she's changed line, then that bloodline of the second family has come into the one family. So then the consideration is sapinda. Means they have a common relative within seven generations. So that's why, besides knowing the gotra, you should know your family line back seven generations. Because otherwise you may have a common, you know, grandfather or granduncle or somebody like that. So then they generally check that they both these are not there. There's no common relative from intermarriage, and you're not the same gotra. And that they're of equal nature. Means if the boy and girl, they should be of the same varnic nature, the inherent nature, like that. So then it will be a successful marriage, because then they'll have the same expectations, same methodology, same everything. At the same time as their child will be clear. It's clear what this child is. Otherwise, you'll be of two different minds, like that. I've seen that. I don't know if we discussed that. Yeah, we discussed that before. So you get this thing where they'll get the different thing where mother is one nature, father is the other, and you get two different ones in the same child. So sometimes it confuses them, and sometimes they work it out. You know, they'll take one as prominent and the other as supporting it. But until they work it out, sometimes they're confused. So if the father and mother are same nature, then the child doesn't have that confusion. It becomes very easy from a very early age to have that determination, know what they're going to do, where they're going, like that. So that's the idea, is what's appropriate and what's inappropriate. Then the marriage rites, topic 7, rites lawful for each varna, the 8 marriage rites. You have the Brahma rite, Daiva, Arsha, Prajapatya, Asura, Gandharva, Rakshasa, Paisach, and, oh yeah, that's the 8. So of these, the Brahma rite is the most approved. Brahma means that you'll see these here, there's 8 rites there. So they're in 2 groups, the first 4 and the last 4. Right? So you have Brahma, Daiva, Arsha, and Prajapatya is one group, Asura, Gandharva, Rakshasa, and Paisacha are another group. So the first 4 are considered proper or approved, you know, it means good marriages. The last 4 are considered that they have a fault in them, like that. So the first 4, the one difference, major difference between the two groups is the first group, the father and the family is somehow or another involved in approval or arrangement of the marriage. And in the second, they're not, like that. There it's just based on desire. Though in the Asura, the parents are involved, but we'll get to that. It's not considered approved. So that's there. Of that, the Brahma rite means that the marriage is made by the father arranges the marriage through his, you know, trying to find something, and he gives the girl no strings attached. Like that. So he's confident and he just gives the girl. He makes no claims. Like that. If there's claims, then it falls into a different category. Daiva means the father's performing a yajna, then the priest is performing the yajna, he's impressed with him, feels he's a good match for his daughter, and gives his daughter, you know, in marriage to that priest. That's the daiva. Arsha then means that the boy approaches the girl's family. It means the first two words, the father approaches the boy. This one, the boy approaches the girl's family. And in approaching, then he gives some gift as a respect for the girl. Nowadays, that is being used. Because if it's for the girl, out of respect, he gives it to the family members, but technically they can't use it themselves. If they use it for themselves, it drops into the Asura marriage, which means you sell the daughter. It means the boy has to give as much wealth as he can to please the parents and the girl. Then he gets the girl to marry. So that's the Asura rite. The Asuras do that. They like the girl so much, they'll pay. Like that. And the parents, because they're Asuras, they don't mind selling her. And sometimes they're very prestigious, you know, like that. Yeah, you know. You know, they're talking about it. You know, the girls are talking about, yeah, my marriage, we fetched, you know, this much money, you know, and like that. How much was it yours? Oh, well, we only got this much. So then it's a prestige. Yes, this girl is more valuable. She's more desirable. Therefore, she got more. So, in other words, from the Asura mentality, it's seen in a positive light. You know, it's like, wow, yeah, she's such a nice girl. They'll pay this much for her. Like that. But specifically, this means the Asura rite is used by Asuras. That's their natural rite. And but otherwise, generally, it's only given by the great preachers outside of the, you know, generally the Vaishnav lines, or even the Vedic lines, for those who don't appreciate daughters. So because they would take their daughter and bury her in the sand when she's born, therefore then they prescribe the Asura rite. Hey, don't bury her, she's worth a lot of money. You know, then, oh, okay, yeah, okay, we'll put in the time now, and then when she gets married, we'll get the money back. So it's basically done to protect the girls, like that. So it'll be used. Like there's certain communities of this world, I mean, you're talking millions and millions of people, who this is their rite, the main rite. Like that. It's just like I was describing this in Kazakhstan, you know, and I didn't know it was, and then everybody's laughing about it, you know, because that's their normal thing there, you know. So amongst them, you know, all those you know, wild, you know, Central Asians, this is standard for them. That's just the way they do it, you know. So then it's a big prestige. So the girl, you're a wealthy family, so therefore only another wealthy family can marry into your family because only they have the money to pay. So then it in a backwards way then assures that there's equalness, you know, this equality between the boy and girl. So it does it, it gets it done, but in a weird way. So that's why it's considered by the upper class to not be very good. Because it's, you know, selling, how can you sell the daughter? Because the daughter's so dear, so it never comes in. Therefore, in those who follow these other rites in India, from the girl's side of the family, they only give to the boy's side. The boy's side never takes anything from the girl's side. Like one devotee was telling me that when they go, let's say the mother goes the boy's mother goes to the girl's house for something. You know, there's some program going on. She goes there and they'll feed her and take care of her, but before she leaves, she'll leave some donation. And you say that, and he was explaining this to me while he was describing the servants, that these servants that are in the family, like generational. You know, it's like the servant, he was his father's servant, and now his child is there, he becomes the son's servant. And like this it goes down. He says, they even know all these traditions of the family. So it says even when the girl is taken back to the girl's house, like that, then the servants many times will take, because other family members won't take because of that inconvenience of taking something from their family. So even he'll just drop the girl and leave, you know, and go and eat outside in the restaurant or something. Or if they do feed him, then he'll also leave a donation. And that's his own money. It's not that the family's giving him. That's his own money, because he follows the same tradition. Because that's one of the principles of that loyalty, is that following the tradition of who you are working under, who you are dependent upon. So they have the same mood. So these first four are very careful about that, that nothing is ever given for the girl. It means for the family. Things are given to the girl, but never to the family. Otherwise it'll be seen as business, like that. Then we've described the Asura rite. The Gandharva rite means mutual love. It's a love marriage, and its purpose is sex. That's what a Gandharva marriage is. That's how you can tell it's Gandharva. Oh, we missed one. Prajapatya. Prajapatya means is that the father was not able to find a match for the girl through his offices. So then the girl, through her offices, finds the boy. That doesn't mean she goes out on the street and goes, hi. She has people who do the same work for her as the father would be doing for himself. So she's made the arrangement. But then the father approves of it. So it still therefore comes into the first four that are considered good. So the girl can choose if she's, you know, of age and the father hasn't made arrangements. So then she can choose, but the father has to approve. If the father doesn't approve, then it falls into Gandharva. Like that. Then Rakshasa means, you know, we hear the Kshatriyas use that, you know, you come into the house, break into the house, steal the girl, fight with anybody who opposes, you know, like that, and then make off with the girl, you know, like that. Very romantic, but a little wild. And then the Paisach, then that's considered the basis of all the rites. So the Asura rite and the Paisach rite are forbidden by Manu. He's just listed what are ways people get married. Then of these, only six are allowed. The Asura, he says, he doesn't approve of. And the Paisach also he doesn't. Paisach means when the girl is asleep or disoriented or in some way emotionally disturbed, or that she doesn't realize what's going on, then the boy comes and grabs her. Like that. So then that's considered the lowest. So that's the way the Paisaches work, right? It means these names, because that's how that group of living entities functions. Rakshasas, that's how they get married. You know, the Paisaches, that's how they get married. The Asuras, that's how they get married. Gandharvas, that's how they get married. Like that. So the Gandharva, right, they just exchange a ring or a garland, just something to show that they mutually both agree. That's it, finished. Like that. So six are allowed, two are rejected. So we see the Rakshasa and the Gandharva, those can be used in the Satya Treta and Dvapara Yugas. But in the Kali Yuga, even those are forbidden. So even though Kshatriyas could use these in other ages, then they don't use them in Kali Yuga. So that therefore, in Kali Yuga, only the first four are considered approved. Like that. The qualities of the rites. So each one gives a better result. Means a son who practices, means he becomes virtuous himself. Then son born of the Brahma rite can save 21 generations. Of the Daiva rite, he can save seven in each direction himself, so that's 15. The Arsha rite, he can save seven. And the Prajapatya, he can save 13. Like that. Why, one would think, why the Prajapatya, the girl choosing the boy is better than the boy choosing the girl, because then the girl will follow that boy, so it'll be a stronger match. Well, if the boy chooses the girl, then she's actually in a strong position, so then she won't be that committed. I mean, she will be committed, but it doesn't have the full respect Well, if the girl means that side approaches the boy, then that respect is greater. Like that. It's not so popular in the West, you know, it's always the boy has to come and get down on his knees and all these kind of things. But then, you know, we see it's not always, you know, maybe a little romantic, but at the same time as if the girl, you know, send, you know, through her offices contacts the boy's family, then it also is quite, you know, like you'll see in, how you say, the the monologues coming from the balcony are more quoted than the monologues that came from the ground. If one, yes. Okay. So we rest our case. Okay, Grihastha Brahmachari, then details aren't given here. So then that means is basically if the husband only approaches his wife during the proper times for having children, then he's considered a brahmachari. Like that. But if he approaches outside of that, then he's not a brahmachari. Like that. And amongst Brahmins, that's considered fallen. You know, others is considered passionate, but amongst Brahmins, that other than that, then it's not considered good. Honor of women, so then the women have to be taken care of. They have to be properly respected. Because if they're not, then it causes problems. The women are happy, the house is very bright, the women aren't happy, it becomes a little less than dull. I mean, or litmus. Yeah, I mean, guess how you say? It's unbright. Like that. And degradation of the family then can come from how you say? Following improper occupations, associating with people who are uncultured, these kind of things, you know, associating with those who are against the Vedic literatures or against devotional service, who don't follow any principles like this, then if one, association here means is they're made intimate. Means in occupational duties, one always has to deal with all these kind of people at the workplace. But to actually bring them home, eat with them, you know, do things together with them, make plans together with them, that kind of thing, that's your own personal life, that's what then comes into the family. That's called bad association. Yes?
Because I have that Western, conception of respecting women, could you tell me how we should behave? Who should first go through the doors and things like that?
If you're dealing with means we'll get into that more later. Means this is just an overview so you get it, but just basically it means if it's man and woman, means who you're dealing with the grihastha area, then the woman goes through the door first. But if you're dealing with the spiritual master, someone like that who's that elevated, then they'll go through the door first. You know, or like that. So you'd have to see. It depends on the situation also. But in other words, when it's something where going through the door where there would be some formality involved, then that senior person would go through first. But if it's not, then generally you would see the women would be taken care of first. You know, just like here, like when they do the parikram. They put the women's buses that are easiest to get to. They put the men's buses at a different distance. Like that. But then they would put like senior persons, like they have the sannyasis in there, they would put their vehicles also close by. But it's like the men, they can take the trouble and take the walk. Like that. So it depends, you have to see the situation. Like that. Does that make some sense? Yeah, like that. Then the topic 8, the 5 great sacrifices, Pancha Mahayagya. So then the great sacrifices are there because in every grihastha's house, they have 5 slaughterhouses. Like that, every grihastha maintains their broom, their fire that they cook with, the fireplace, the water, what you drink from, you know, those things, the grinding stone, or, you know, and the mortar and pestle. Because whenever they're used, then millions of living entities are killed. So because of this, then the grihastha has to perform these pancha mahayagyas, these 5 great sacrifices, to free themselves from the sin of that. So these are also then connected to, we hear Prabhupada talk about this, the debts that we owe, right? So these are annulled by these five debts. We have debts, just by being born, we have debts to the demigods because they control everything, and they're the ones that make the body work, you know, open and close the eyes and do everything and provide the sun and moon and rain and vegetables. So, demigods. Then the forefathers, just that we're born into the family means that there had to be somebody before us. So just that we could be born into the family means that your father had to have a father. Right? So just that, so we owe a debt to them, that we have that, because being born in that family, then we get the whatever the benefits are of being born in that family. Like you're born in a rich family, it's just you're automatically rich. You automatically have that prestige and all that. So that goes to you owe a debt to the forefathers for that. Then to the sages, because they give the scriptures and reveal the scriptures. So you have a debt to them. Then you have a debt to mankind, because you have a social system, you can't live on your own. So because of the whole social structure, you owe something to mankind in general. And because there's all kinds of ghosts and everything that are also involved in the whole setup, they have duties and all that, and they're taking care of things for you, you have a debt to them. So by performing these five great sacrifices, then one frees oneself from this debt. So this debt is there for the grihasthas, because they're involved in material life. The brahmacharyas, vanaprastha, sannyasas don't, because they're going for liberation. They're not going to benefit themselves in the world. They're not trying to stay here. So they're not using that meaning. So they don't have that. They're either under a guru, like the brahmacharya is under his guru. He's a grihastha. He's doing this. The brahmachari, vanaprastha, and yas don't. Vanaprasthas, if they're living with the wife, then they generally continue them. But if they don't live with the wife, then they don't have to. Like that.
Maharaj, is the broom and the process of sweeping also considered one of the sopanas?
Yeah, the broom is one of them. Like that. Yes?
What are these duties performed by the ghosts?
Just like in the house, Vastu, he holds up the house, he's a ghost. So everything is going, your whole well-being and not is all part of him. So they have little duties like that. You know, they're not like the main duties, but there are all these side duties like that. So the demigods take care of the main ones, but there's all kinds of secondary, and they take care of that.
Like that.
I mentioned Vastu, he's a ghost. So Vastu has 64 ghosts that work under him, that deal in all the different corners of the house, like that. So they take care of all kinds of things in the house.
Yeah. Sometimes I noticed in the house something seems to have changed. You know, like an offering cup would have a mouth which has not been provoked by me. And then I wonder, maybe it's
just
something is happening.
Maybe, you have to see. You know, unless some bird came in the window and was trying to, or squirrels, or like that. However they get it, their work done. But these are secondary. So for the devotees, then these are taken care of by devotional service. This is the up. You know, the... You know his name? What does he call it? The upside, yeah? The upside is that devotees, then because they're performing devotional service, they don't have to separately take care of these five yagyas. It's taken care of by devotional service. But within that, then we see as part of the culture, it's already worked in, that the debt to the demigods we don't worry about, because that's through sacrifice. And so we perform the ultimate sacrifice of the Sankirtan. So by performing that sacrifice, you don't have to perform the sacrifice for the demigods. Then the sacrifice for the sages are study of the scriptures. So that's already part of our process anyway. It's already part of the Bhagavad process. So they're already satisfied. So you don't have to separately deal with them. Then for mankind is feeding guests, feeding the Brahmins. So that's already, then, if one is doing that, that's taken care of. like that. Then he takes care of the dependents in the family by, you know, feeding themselves, feeding himself. So if they, and if they're taking prasad and they're taking, engaged in devotional service, then all these things are taken care of. Otherwise, if not, the karmis, they have these debts. They have to pay. So whether they're Vedic, not Vedic, doesn't matter. They have to pay. And so if you don't pay, then there's a problem. Like that. Big problem. So then, yeah. So Prasita Shraddha writes in there, that's also his offering to the mains. So for us, that's, it's not a separate thing one doesn't have to do, because for us, the actual forefathers, is we take the line back through the Acharyas. So we have Prabhupada, we have the previous Acharyas, back to Rupa Goswami. So these are our forefathers. You know, and then that goes back to Krishna. So if you're worshipping Krishna, then he is the origin of all the forefathers. Right? The Pita Maha. So then you don't have to worry separately for him. Right. So otherwise it gives all these different things. Who can sit in a company? Company means a group for sitting for the Shraddha. Who can't? What happens if you give food to those who shouldn't be there? So basically what it says is that if you're feeding Brahmins, better to feed just one, two, three nicely than to feed a whole group. Because generally it's thought, well, if I feed everybody, it'll be best. Like, it's a common thing. It means in the Vaishnav community, it doesn't matter. We feed all the devotees. Somebody's parents die. So then they want to feed as many people as they can. You know, all the gurukuls, all the temple devotees, everybody like that. They feed, you know, hundreds and hundreds. They figure the parents will get the best benefit. But if they're looking at it from the mundane side, then better they feed three people or even just one properly. Because you have so many there. Now, if somebody doesn't get taken care of properly, doesn't get enough, is slighted in any way, then your whole endeavor is lost. Like that. So it's not just that you fed, it's how the quality of it. You know, it's just like if you want to have, you know, a program at your house, you only invite as many people as you can take care of. Better a few people taken care of nicely, it'll be a nicer atmosphere than have so many you can't take care and everything's going crazy and nobody appreciates. So that's a principle given there. And then it says, of that, then those who are Kshatriyas, those who are properly engaged in devotional service, they're the ones to invite. Like that. Not someone who is not very spiritual. And it gives so many different details on the origin and the mains, and then the different kinds of worship, the sacrificial food, and then the times for the Shraddha. So, for the devotees, then, these aren't really important elements. Then, discourse 4, the modes of gaining subsistence. Now that he's married, because the last one is marriage rites, and then what are the duties inherent from being grihastha? Those inherent. Then, from that, now he should, how he's going to maintain himself. He has to maintain himself. So then that's described. So the modes that he should use are what will cause little or no pain to others. Whatever is done should be done in such a way. Brahman's life should not give problem to others. And whatever will gain the bare necessities. How much he needs and requires for his lifestyle that he's comfortable at, then that much only. Don't try to go more. In other words, he should set what is his lifestyle and then establish it at that and be comfortable with that. Because satisfaction is actually the root of happiness. We discussed that. So if you've set something, you're satisfied with that, you'll be happy. Because otherwise going beyond what one's means, one's never happy. So one should see what is one's means, what comes easily, and then do that. Like Prabhupada gives the guideline is that you go out and do 8 hours of work a day. So what comes by that, then you live by that. Don't make plans beyond that or you'll always be dissatisfied. You make your plans within that, then you can always be satisfied. If you get X amount of money and you make your plans based on that, then you'll be satisfied. But if you take it beyond that, then how you'll be satisfied? Because you have your means, you can't get more than that. So then, so that's the point being made. Just what one requires, then that's it. Don't go beyond. 6 modes of subsistence. then is he can glean from the fields or what people don't want, then he can, that's called Ritta, which means truth. Then Mritta, death, that's begging, because it's, you know, one has to be humble to do that. Amrita means taking just what comes without any endeavor. You make no endeavor for any, how you say, economics, and whatever you get just from doing nothing. You know, just engaging in your sadhana and other things, whatever comes, then that comes. Like you see Sudama Brahman, he lived by Amrita. He didn't go out. He just studied, did whatever was his brahminical duties, whatever people gave. Then he had. Sometimes you get more, sometimes less. The same with that python sadhu. Ajigarbhata is the same thing. Is you just sit in one place and you don't bother going out anywhere. And whatever you get. Because you can also go out. Means of this Amrita you have the two parts. You go out, perform your duties anywhere, whatever people give you, then that's there. Ajigar just means you sit in one place, don't bother going out to people's programs and yajnas and that, and then whatever you get sitting there. So that's why Prahlad Maharaj was very surprised. He came across this sadhu just laying on the road, and he was quite fat. He was saying, how is he so fat? He's just laying on the road and following Ajigar Vrata. Like that. So then he explains. Just whatever you do, whether you work for it or not, it's going to come to you. So that's not the thing. It's what's in the future. So since I don't want anything of this mundane world, I do no mundane work. I only engage in the spiritual. Like that. So that's Ritta. I mean, that's Amrita. Then Pramrita means that which causes many deaths. So that's farming. Because when you plow the fields and all kinds of bugs, this, that. But that's the duty of the Vaishyas is to agriculture and cow protection. Then Satyanrita means half truth, half lie. And that's called business. Right? Business and banking, those are Satyanrita. So those five can be followed by the Dvijas. Like that, or by the Brahmins. But the last Shvabrita, that means taking service of others, then that's generally avoided. You know, if it can be avoided, then that's best. If not, then it's not a problem. Like that. So if it's not a time of distress, then you can do. I mean, then you wouldn't do. If you can't find one's natural, occupational endeavor, there's no facility for it, then one can start taking these other ones. Like that. Let him never follow the ways of the world, and contentment is the root of happiness. And topic 10. So this is his modes of living. Then now will be different duties. As a householder, now what are his duties? So then, let him not seek wealth through pursuits to which men cleave. So then, in other words, what people do for the sense gratification, that he shouldn't find his livelihood through that. And then consistency of dress, speech, and thoughts means according to his age, according to his social position, then he should dress. Right? So it's very obvious. You're an older person, you dress older. You're younger, you dress younger. The Brahmin, they dress in that way. The Kshatriya, they dress in that way. So you get like that. You know, so then you wouldn't get, like nowadays, you see so many entertainers, they're in the 60s and they're still trying to look like they're in the 20s, you know, like that. It means they try hard, they spend a lot of money. But Vedas recommend, you know, don't bother with that. Just, you know, like that. He should study. He should always be engaged in study. That's his foremost duty, and he should never allow other things to get in the way of that. It means his study should be his main thing. It means even though it's a little, whatever it is, but his occupation shouldn't cut out his study, is what it means. Don't, in other words, be so engaged in economic development that you have no time to study. So that's the point it makes. So study must always go on. Because by study, then one gains knowledge. By study, one gains, understands how to perform one's duties, one's enlivened. By study, one is able to teach others. So that must always be there. And then then one has to find the balance, as we saw before, between the spiritual and material. Find what is the balance, that how much time he needs to spend for his economics, for his family, all these things, but at the same time as get in some time to study. And let him never neglect sacrifice, so he should always be engaged in sacrificial duties like that. Then there's a whole run of so many different things that in this outline, and there's not so much detail, so you won't see, because there's so many small things in each verse, it's hard to pick. Though so in the next outline you'll get, and you'll see more detail. So you should always be respectful towards the deities, the Brahmins, and things that are auspicious. He must be sense controlled in regards to his wife, so he's not, as Prabhupada mentions, he doesn't keep his wife as a sex machine. Respectful dealings during hygiene, so he's, you know, if he's unclean, he doesn't touch things that are clean. Respect for its fire, he deals with fire, he doesn't, you know, throw unclean things in the fire, he doesn't warm his feet by the fire, he's respectful towards the fire. Then his attire then is proper, you know, as discussed before. He shouldn't dwell in a place where the sacred law is not obeyed. In other words, he should have association. He shouldn't be out on his own with no association. There should always be some association that they can gain so that they can, maintain their spiritual enthusiasm, their proper enthusiasm. Otherwise, if they're in a place where there isn't anybody who is like that, then they'll always get trouble from them, and they won't have the association to keep that strength. Care in eating, you know, so he's careful what he eats, that is proper, that is offered. Care during travel, they won't do anything that's, risky, you know, like that. He wouldn't take any risk while traveling. It means physical risk. In other words, if it's a choice between something that would be physically dangerous and something that's not, then a Brahmin will always choose what's not, because he can't be the one who is responsible for the death of a Brahmin, right? Because that carries a reaction. Killing a Brahmin is the heaviest of all sins that there is, and it's not that the person who is the Brahmin can't be responsible for that. If he kills himself, then he's responsible for killing a Brahmin. Like that. So he has to be careful not to see that he's not the cause of the Brahmin getting injured by his decision. Like that. If something unknown, what can you do? That's karma. But the scriptures give certain things to be careful of so that you understand how. Yes, snataka just means he's just graduated. Kshatriya means that he's actually generally practiced. He's a practiced, you know, practicing Brahmin. Because a snataka, a brahmachari, you know, and a snataka are based, technically speaking, Brahmins. But at the same time, is they're not performing the occupation of. So a kshatriya generally would be someone who is a practicing Brahmin. But at the same time, a kshatriya can also mean anyone who's advanced in spiritual knowledge and practicing it. So you could have brahmacharis who are kshatriyas, because you have these sages. Some of them are vanaprastas, some of them are grihastas, some of them are brahmacharis. Like Narad Muni would be a kshatriya, but he's a brahmachari. Vasishtha would be a kshatriya, he's a grihasta. You know? So you'd get these, or someone like Vasishtha, you know. I think he's in between, you know. Like that, he's more like a vanaprastha. So you'd get these different situations, you know, or you, like that. They can live in these. The Brahmins have these situations. Kind of, they can be slightly in between. Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, no. Like that, you know. It's just like they can't be. But like you say, so like Vyasadeva, he's not married, but at the same time, as hasn't taken the vow of sannyas, he's not a brahmachari because he's finished his studies just by being basically born to Parasara Muni and being the incarnation of the Lord's writing potency, the literary potency. So he's not a brahmachari, he's not a snataka. Same time, he's not a sannyasi. So then he can beget children on his brother's wife. you know. But at the same time, is then he goes back to living his lifestyle. He has no obligation in there. So you do get that kind of position in between. The munis, rishis, many times are in that. They haven't taken sannyas. They haven't taken that vow. You know, like the four kumaras, they've taken that vow. You know, Narad Muni's taken that vow. So then they don't get involved. But then there's others that haven't taken that vow but aren't married. Like that. So then they may get more involved in you know, family affairs and things like that. But, yeah. Does that make sense?
And with regards to respect of the fire, if you're not allowed to blow on Agni because it's disrespectful, but for the deep flames, if you put your hand like this and then blow, is it...
Yeah, you can blow through something. You just don't blow directly on the fire. Like if you want to blow out a candle, you don't blow on it directly because then it's coming from your mouth. You blow through the hand. You know, like when they the fire needs fanning, right? So you don't blow on it directly. You use a fan or they use a pipe, like that. And that way, then it goes. You know. Today full moon. let him not do anything useless. So a Brahmin shouldn't do anything that doesn't have any purpose. Like he can't just sit there and, you know, pull up, you know, grass while he's sitting there, or take dirt clods and break them into powder, or bite his nails, or scratch the ground with his toes, or, you know, anything that doesn't have any purpose. So whatever, he should avoid that. And avoiding bad association we discussed. So gifts to be avoided, then, if it's coming from materialistic people, one has to be very careful. Gifts may be accepted if they're coming from a wrong place. If it's a gift that comes without asking, it can be accepted from anyone. But but one wouldn't use it for oneself. Right? It means if you use it yourself, you get the karma of that low-class person. But them giving it to a Brahmin is purified. Then the Brahmin can use it for dependence, or give it in charity, give it to other Brahmins, give it to the temple, give it to the sadhus. But he can't use it in any way that will be something that he'll get benefit from. So he can't say, oh, okay, I'll use it to feed my family, but he also takes that food. He could buy things for the family that only they use that he doesn't use. Otherwise, it should be given in charity. Like Prabhupada, if you get bad money like that, he generally just put it in the deity's box, like that. Someone was telling me, I think, yeah, there's some, I forget where he was, but the persons, they were running, their business was somehow or another not, you know, above board, so very wealthy, and they gave him a big donation, but he just put it in the deity's box. But other donations that he considered good, then he would put it into those funds that he would use for different things, you know, for travel or for different projects, how he'd want to use them and all that. You know, so if it's too bad, just give it in charity. If it's not so bad, then it can be used more closely, but one can never use it for oneself. If it's good, only then one can use it for oneself.
Yes. What is the value of if a aspiring devotee is getting inheritance from his family? His family having gained this luxury from impious means, mundane means.
Well, mundane is one thing, as long as it was honest. But here it means that. Here, I think the donation Prabhupada got was from a family that ran a huge distillery. They were like the biggest distillery in that part of the world. So that kind of money, you know. That are, you know, from, you know, brothels, from this, from that, all these different things. Anything that's considered sin. If it's just normal day-to-day business and this and that, that's another thing, because that's just doing their mundane duties. So that's considered, you know, okay. But if it's actually from sinful means, then one has to be more careful, because that will carry with it that karma. You know, it's inheritance, so that's one thing, because it's something you do. It's not something you're not do, like in charity. But at the same time, one has to be careful, because bad money will ruin the family. I've heard of also families who... A grandfather was working for a king. He was the treasurer for the king. And then at independence, then all the kings went down. And then I think something happened to the king, or there was some intrigue. I think it was independence, maybe it was earlier. Some intrigue happened, and then things went haywire, so then that grandfather, he took money. Because it was gotten by improper means, then gradually, by the third generation, they were paupers, even though it was a huge amount of money. So that was gained by illegal means. But if it's gained by, you know, your proper legal methods, even though it's mundane, it's still considered, you know, good money. It may not be fabulous money, but it's... So if it's used in Krishna's service and things like that, then it's purified.
If we use it for ourselves, then you get some reaction.
Yeah, then you get some reaction. Like that. But if it's inheritance, then, you know, there's not much... I mean, if that's what you live by, there's not much you can do about that. You know? But then one should see that it's being used in purposes beyond one's own. Does that make some sense? Like that.
Okay. How do you consider then what is used for ourselves and what is for the natural service? Because we eat.
Yeah, anything that you personally would use, that's what it means. It means your own clothes, your own food, your own staying arrangements, you wouldn't use anything that you personally would
use. The food you cook, it's for Krishna and
yeah, but what I'm saying is that you're getting the benefit from it. But things that are for your dependents, it can be used for that. That you're not getting any benefit from, or given to the temple or to saintly persons. Like that. Brahmins, like this. Then there's, you get the benefits from that, but you don't get the reactions. Does that make some sense? If you directly will get something out of it, then that's what's avoided. But otherwise, then bad money, if it's used for those other purposes, you don't get the reaction, and neither do the people you're using it for, because it's been purified by already being given to the Brahmin. Right? And then the Brahmin then is giving it again. So it's already purified. So their dependents or the sadhus or like that aren't affected by it. It's only the first person who received it. If he uses it for himself, then he gets reaction. But if he doesn't use it for himself, then it's not. Does that make some sense? You know, there may be things you can... Yeah, you'd have to just see what is the nature. But it would be direct personal things like that. Now, whether you use it beyond in the things in the service that you use for the service, but you don't call them yours. They're there for the service. But then that will be tested if you stop doing that service. Do you take those things with them? Do you take the computer with you? Do you take the car with you? Do you take the... You understand? Then it means it was yours. Then you get the reaction. But if it's like you set this service up and all that, here are the facilities, now you're moving on from that, those facilities stay, then it wasn't for you, you get no reaction from that. So that's how you... In other words, it means there's a mentality that's there. It's not so much a rule. You know what I'm saying? The rule is for a mentality. It's just like, let's say, we want to ensure that let's say somebody has a particular mentality of being pleasant. So therefore you make so many rules that would ensure someone's pleasant. But the rules aren't the real thing. What you're trying to do is just get them to be gentle. Right? Those are just in place to remind you and see that even if you had a bad day, still it works. Right? Because you'll follow the rule because it's there. But the real thing is get to what's the purpose behind those rules. So that's the whole reason for studying this, is that it's what's the purpose behind. Because they'll give, you know, one or two examples, but it's the principle that's there, you know. You know, it's like it says, don't warm your feet by the fire. Was it all if I wore my shoes? You know, I'm not warming my feet. I'll warm my shoes and then I'll put them on my feet. You know, I don't throw anything dirty in the fire. Okay, I didn't throw it. I kicked it in the fire. Or I don't throw it, but I get the kid to throw it in the fire. Is that okay? You understand? So in other words, they give enough examples of rules so that the principle behind it is established. Because the rules themselves aren't what's actually important. The rule is what you're trying to get to, is that respect for the water, for the fire, for the air, for the ether, for the earth. Because those are Krishna's elements. So that means if you respect them, then you respect the devas, you respect Brahma, you respect Krishna. So you're trying to get to that. You respect the spirit, your parents, so you respect your teachers. You respect them, you respect the gurus. You respect them, then you're going to respect the residents of the spiritual realm. You respect them, you respect Krishna. So they have a purpose that goes all the way back to the Lord. So that's why it's the Niyamagraha means you're just following these rules and saying, I'm doing everything perfect. And externally you are. But actually the purpose of the rule has been missed. So therefore, Niyamagraha. They missed the point. That's fanatic. You're doing the rule, but you don't know the purpose behind it. Just that you're doing it, that's not fanatic. Is that it's being done just for the purpose of doing it. It's pious. But one always has to remember, following these rules, one's fanatic, it's pious. So, but the problem is that unless it's connected to the Lord, you don't really get the benefit that the rule is meant for. Does that make sense? Yeah, so that's why you'll see Prabhupada will mention these things to be followed, but at the same time he'll point out the weaknesses of it if you only take that thing itself and not connect it to Krishna. Does that make sense? So that's the thing. Like, we respect the demigods, but we don't worship them. Right? So there's that balance. We respect, don't worship. The Madhuas respect and worship. The Shris don't respect, don't worship. Right? Shris won't nothing. They won't go into a demigod temple, won't deal anything with them, nothing. Because they only deal with Vishnu. If they deal with Vishnu, then all the demigods are taken care of. Because they worship the Lord and His eternal associates, and the demigods here are simply expansions of those associates. So they're already worshiping the demigods. But the original, not the ones here. Well, the Madhuas, then they see that they're servants of the Lord. Right? But they're taking the posts of energies of the Lord and the devotees who are doing those services, so then they respect them. Like that. And some they worship, most they don't. Well, we basically don't. We respect them, but don't worship. That makes sense?
Okay. Would you say that the Shris are Kanishtha bhaktas?
No, they can be advanced. Okay. But it's just that they're just looking at it, they're only looking at it from that angle. And the Lord and His associates. So the demigod here, let's say you take Ganesh, then in the spiritual world you have Vishvaksena. So you worship Vishvakshena, his potency is what Ganesh uses to get his work done. Right? So you're already worshiping the person who he gets it done. Just like, in other words, it's saying you're respecting the officer, but you don't deal with his secretaries and servants. So you can do that. You know? The Madhuas, then they'll take it that the secretary is there, the servants are there. You know, so basically we use both. Bhaktivinoda Thakur also says we don't worship Ganesh, we worship Vishvaksena. Like that. But we don't have anything bad to say about the demigods. That's why it says don't blaspheme the demigods. Because they're devotees and they're doing the Lord's service. But we don't approach them for mundane things, mundane purposes. Does that make sense? Like that. Good. And that's the okay. So then time is up. We should end here. Okay, so this is 4. Okay. Most of this will go through quick because there's so many technical points that there's very little detail. Like that. On. So this next section will go through quite quickly. Okay. So I think. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki, Janitai Gaura Prema Nandini.